May 1 is a formal holiday in most of the world outside the United States. It's a celebration of the struggle for workers' rights. But the holiday that we don't formally celebrate is founded upon events that occurred in the United States, and specifically in Chicago in May 1886. Now, it's not a coincidence that we don't get a day off of work, that it's not a formal holiday in the United States. In the 19th century, after some severe labor unrest, President Grover Cleveland declared Labor Day to be a holiday that would focus upon the virtue of labor. He placed it in September to avoid focus upon the events in May, in part because he wanted to discourage protests. That diversion of attention became even more complete when President Eisenhower designated May 1 as Loyalty Day in the United States. But I think the events of May Day back in 1886 are highly relevant to us, particularly in this climate today. It's a story of oppressed workers fighting for rights against enormous odds while being demonized for their status as immigrants. So I'd like you to bear with me and I'd like to summarize them. On May 1, 1886, an estimated 300,000 industrial workers around the United States organized a one-day strike. They protested, and their cause was the demand for an eight-hour workday. Chicago was the center of the movement, where 40,000 joined the one-day strike. Most of the strikers were German and Bohemian immigrants. Business owners strongly opposed the strikers, and they looked for a way to generate public opposition to the relatively popular concept of an eight-hour day. So 130 years ago, they figured out that in the United States, you could distract people from the substantive issues by claiming that these immigrants didn't belong here in the first place and were ruining our country. They knew there was great prejudice towards new European immigrants and religious bias against Catholics. These business owners controlled the newspapers and used them to spread fear. So, for example, an article in the Chicago Post-Mail described Bohemian immigrants, and I quote, as depraved beasts, harpies, decayed physically and spiritually, mentally and morally thievish and licentious. Another Chicago paper agreed, the Chicago Times. It said the city was becoming, and I quote, the cesspool of Europe. Let us whip these Slavic wolves back to the European dens from which they issue, or in some way exterminate them. Well, protests in Chicago continued during that week of May. On May 3rd, outside the McCormick Reaper plant, where immigrant workers struck, police shot and killed several workers at the end of a rally. And this was really sensitive in Chicago because a decade earlier, there had been a railroad strike where hundreds of workers had been gunned down. So on May 4th, strikers gathered at the Haymarket Square to protest the police shootings the previous night. It was a peaceful protest. 2,000 people showed up. The Chicago mayor attended to watch, but he went home before it ended because it was an unremarkable event. Near the end of the protest, there were about 500 people left, but the Chicago police decided to order the crowd to disperse. 175 police started marching towards the crowd. And at that point, someone whose identity is unknown to this day tossed a bomb into the crowd that killed a policeman and injured others. The police returned fire to the crowd, killing unknown numbers of civilians. Now, this terrible act of violence by one person became the opportunity to demand retribution against the strikers. One newspaper headline read, "Outcasts from foreign lands bring their horrible practices across the ocean." The next day, martial law was declared in Chicago. Homes were searched without warrants. 200 labor leaders were thrown into jail. When it was all over, the police decided to arrest 8 labor leaders and charge them with murder and conspiracy. Of the 8 charged, only 2 had actually been at the rally when the bomb went off. Only 3 were involved in the rally at all. Days after the protests, another six police died of wounds suffered on the night of May 4th. The newspapers reported they were killed by the bomb. And not to diminish any death, but evidence uncovered later showed that most of the police were killed from the indiscriminate fire that the police fired into the crowd in response to the bomb. So the defense went to trial. Seven of the eight were immigrants. A Law Review article said they were, quote, long-haired, wild-eyed, bad-smelling, atheistic, reckless foreign wretches. Given the pretrial publicity and perhaps aided by the bailiff selection process, all 12 jurors acknowledged prejudice against the defendants. But the judge ruled that as long as the juror said he thought he could be fair, he would not be struck from the case for cause, and the defense quickly ran out of challenges. Prosecutors could never identify the bomb thrower and couldn't say, therefore, how the defendants conspired with that person. They didn't present any evidence linking the defendants to the bomb. Instead, they told the jury that anarchy was on trial. The defendants, they said, needed to be hanged in order to save civilization. Well, the jury, in fact, found all the defendants guilty. They were sentenced to death. There were some rapid appeals that failed, and after that, one committed suicide and four were hanged. Years later, the next governor of Illinois, John Peter Altgeld, reluctantly agreed to consider clemency petitions for the remaining three defendants. Altgeld said he would never offer clemency on the grounds of mercy, because if any of them were involved in the crime, he didn't think they deserved mercy. But after he reviewed the trial transcripts, he found no evidence to support a conviction. He said the defendants instead were victims of hysteria, a packed jury, and a biased judge. So he pardoned the remaining three defendants. In return, the newspapers attacked Altgeld, and he was rewarded by being defeated in his reelection campaign. And by the way, if you ever visit the Third Unitarian Church in Chicago, there is in fact a mural of John Peter Altgeld in the church as a tribute to his courage. And I suspect it's probably one of the few instances anywhere where there's a portrait of a politician in a Unitarian church. So a couple years later, in 1889 in Paris, an international convention of workers declared that May 1st should be a holiday to honor the martyrs of Chicago. And in most countries, May 1 is either Labor Day or International Workers' Day. The Haymarket Affair is just one incident in the long history of the US labor movement. And throughout that history, workers came from the bottom of the economic ladder. They were typically immigrants. Fear of violence from those immigrants was a tool used to keep public opinion on the side of employers. And I'm not going to attempt to summarize all of labor history, but even the songs we heard today tell you part of that story. Joe Hill was a real person. He was a Swedish immigrant born Joel Emanuel Haglund. And he was a popular songwriter for the union cause and was organizing mine workers in Utah. The worst massacre in US labor history occurred at the coal mine in Ludlow, Utah in 1914. And Joe Hill was at a Utah copper mine when he was likely framed on a murder charge. Woodrow Wilson was one of those who sought clemency for Joe Hill, but it was a state crime and the governor of Utah thought he should face the firing squad. Employers also used prejudice of the union workers to try and create divisions within the ranks. Strikebreakers were often from different ethnic groups, and African Americans were at the bottom of the economic rung. The last song we heard, Bread and Roses, was based upon a poem written in 1911. And in 1912, the Lawrence textile strike in Massachusetts became known as the Bread and Roses Strike. And that strike defied conventional wisdom because it was a strike involving multiple plants in Lawrence, Massachusetts. And the workers there, the women there, spoke a total of 51 different languages. No one thought they could come together, but they did. Although they did complain that union meetings took a long time because of the difficulty communicating. I think there are a lot of reasons why these events of more than 100 years ago are relevant to us today. There are political themes that we see today, and they're carried forward. But for here, I think there are also some spiritual lessons I'd like to focus on, a few of them. You know, and the first is gratitude, and gratitude comes in two forms. One form of gratitude is for the labor that provides for us every day. Breck's poem reminds us how the great events in history are attributed to a few individuals, but at each event, thousands of unnamed and forgotten people labored to make it happen. In our children's story today, the character who stood out to me was the man who worked in the office building who never thought about the janitors. You know, he went to the office every day, he made his office a mess, he filled his garbage can, he went home. The next morning he showed up, his office was clean, the garbage can was empty, and he never thought about the janitors. The worker was invisible until he saw that protest. Today, with our advanced division of labor, we're so separated from the people who do the work. And it's easy to forget about the people who plant, harvest, transport, and prepare our food. 200 years ago in America, if an American ate, they might have farmed the food they ate. They might have known the person who made their shoes. If they bought textiles from a store, they at least might have known the store owner. But today our division of labor is so advanced that we have little or no connection to the individuals who make our food or our goods, and it's easy not to think about them. But the story of the Haymarket leads me to a second form of gratitude, and that's more applicable to the concept of May Day as opposed to Labor Day. Whatever abuses we see in the workplace today, the challenges these people faced were so much worse. I think the Barack Obama quote summed it up. We expect agreement now that there should be no child labor. The 8-hour day should be enforced. For those workers, dangerous factory conditions were just an expected part of life. If you were hurt, you just stopped working, you received no assistance, the employer just brought in the next person behind you. So for us, we're so fortunate to live in a time and a place where those battles had been fought. Millions before us worked hard to achieve that progress in the workplace. Thousands died, thousands suffered, and many died, leaving behind families with no support. You know, those at the McCormick Reaper plant or at Haymarket or at the Utah mines were just a few of the people who died for the cause, and we live to enjoy the fruits of that sacrifice. So there's no way we can pay those people back. The only way to be thankful and to show gratitude is fight the next battle for those who follow us. We have our own set of challenges, but true gratitude's more than a feeling, that it should prompt us to action. And that was Julie Taylor's message in our prayer. If we're grateful to those who came before us, the best we can do is show gratitude to fight the next battle. Even if we're not around to see victory, others will be. A second takeaway, though, I have had from the Haymarket story is my awe for the willingness of these workers to keep fighting against incredible odds. You know, in this past year, we've all felt at times like we're going backwards, and sometimes it seems like the road ahead has so many obstacles that it's just overwhelming. We're tempted to despair. In our culture today, when we face an issue, we're so primed for instant gratification. We love the story of an underdog who encounters a problem, faces obstacles, and overcomes challenges. But that story has to fit within the confines of a 2-hour movie or a television show. Struggles that are worth fighting for take a long time. So then I think about these immigrants who fought for the 8-hour day. And just as an exercise, I'd like to ask you to join me in a thought experiment. Imagine you're at a Las Vegas casino. You have $100 in your hand. You get to place a bet on which side you think will win a struggle. On the one side, you have the wealthiest people in the country. They control all the large businesses in a time when there's a surplus of labor. They control the newspapers, which was the only mass media at the time. They exert great influence over the politicians, the police, the courts, and the military. On the other side, there's a group of immigrants with little formal education who speak broken English. They have little money, don't control any media. On which side would a rational person place that bet? But in the end, who won the struggle for the 8-hour day? To be sure, these immigrants lost a lot of battles along the way. Some paid dearly, often with their lives. But as a group, they just kept on fighting. They didn't despair. Their fight took years. Many didn't leave to see the victory, but one after another, they keep fighting until they succeeded. So for a minute or two each day this week, try to think about the challenges those men and women faced before winning the fight. Think about them in the context of the struggles you face, whether they're personal, whether it's in relationships, or whether it involves social causes. Those workers, despite setbacks, just kept fighting, and so should we. And the third point I'd like to emphasize was the ability of these workers to overcome differences and join together as one community. The women of Lawrence could have fallen prey to internal divisions. The Bread and Roses strike, they spoke 51 languages and came together. In the May Day protests of 1886, the immigrant workers from across the country chose the issue of the 8-hour day as a way to come together. But I think there's a broader issue here of community about how we all need to be alert to attempts to cause divisions among workers. The struggle of these workers sometimes touched upon money, but that wasn't the real issue. Like Carlitos in our story, he didn't care about money. He just wanted to spend more time with his mom. The song Bread and Roses tells us that the labor movement is about the quality of life, not money. The issue of fair wages and a reasonable working day really went to a more important point. The basic principle is that each person ought to be able to devote a reasonable amount of time to work and have some time left over for family and friends. And in a broader sense, I think that's a corollary of our first principle of Unitarian Universalism, that we respect the dignity and worth of each person. Now, I know I've been talking a lot about history today and not much about the labor issues today, but I think the issues of living wage, of wage disparity, wage theft, equal pay, and taking advantage of undocumented workers ultimately go to the same point. These issues touch all workers in some way. And consider now the length of the workday. I think in some ways, there's a sense that that's become much more important to white-collar workers. I know that I've had jobs, and many people in this church have had jobs that sometimes seem all-consuming, where it seems just to survive, let alone to succeed in your work, you have to spend most of your time at it and most of your emotional energy. There have been times in my career when I've spent less time than I should have with a sick parent, less time than I should have with a child in need. There have been times when I was physically present for my family, but my mind was someplace else, and it was all for a job. Fairness and equity in the workplace is an issue for all of us, and that's just part of the dignity and worth of each individual. So we can't let people divide us on this point. There's not one group that's entitled and another that's undeserving. I want to suggest to you that when you stand up for the rights of another person to make a living wage, you know, we're not just standing up then for that person and that issue. We're implicitly making a broader point. We're standing up to the right for a meaningful life, a point that applies to you and me. For the workers of May Day, the union was a community that made them stronger. Today, unions aren't as strong, but our success still depends upon the ability to join together in community. Now, 100 years ago, music was an inspiration that helped the workers join together. And with that in mind, we're going to conclude our service today with a song that I think summarizes what Walter Ruther talked about the free march of men and women joined together in the solidarity of brotherhood, of human brotherhood. The song is Solidarity Forever. It shares the same music as John Brown's Body and the Battle Hymn of the Republic. The lyrics were first written by Rolf Chapin in 1915, but this is such a powerful song, it's a living, breathing part of the labor movement, it's been updated. So we've selected verses that have been updated from the 1970s that really emphasize the point of inclusiveness. It affirms the goal that artificial distinctions will not divide us as a people, or distract us from our goal. We will stand united. And now, solidarity forever.